I'd mention one thing. I'm coming to an end, and some of you may be saying, praise the Lord of Acts. So I'm looking at chapter 27 today, and the shipwreck of Paul. And so we only have one more chapter to do. I'm dividing that in two parts. And so I was asking some people, what do you think to do next? Should I do another book or topic? Or so I think the feedback I got, and I'm going to take it up, is look at the Lord's Prayer for a time together. So we did this a couple of years ago with a Lenten study, and I just thought it was some really insightful things pulled out from there. Some who are in that study may hear a little bit of the same, but some I hope will hear all of us something new as well. The Lord's Prayer, I don't think it can be exhausted, so let's look at that in the coming weeks of May. Let's look today then at Acts chapter 27. The seas are not always calm, I was thinking when I read this. And so, you know, it's not only true of Paul's journey from Caesarea, the capital of the Roman province, Judea, there, all the way over to Rome. Just look at how many places, as we're going to hear shortly, he stopped at on his way, eventually getting shipwrecked. It's true also for us as Christians, I think. The seas are not always calm. Some people think, well, you know, when I give my life to Christ, it's just going to be streets of heaven paved with gold and, you know, nothing wrong in my life. I hear TV preachers sometimes say this kind of thing. And, you know, from the beginning, the wisest of the Christians, early Christians, knew that this was nothing but bunkum. It's not true. As Jesus himself said, you know, about the Tower of Siloam that fell on a whole bunch of people and killed them, he asked, you know, which was the greater sinner? And he pointed out, well, not one of them. This is the way the world is, this fallen world in which we live. But the way we respond, that makes all the difference, isn't it? Someone and Job's wife counseled him to curse God when he came upon all his troubles. For tomorrow you'll die. But we know as Christians, you know, there's a lot more to our life than just the present moment. I've heard of people who, you know, have committed suicide and that they've just, had they held out a moment longer. I was speaking with my grandson who has, he's bipolar and is in a real dive. Just this week. And, you know, he has a friend who committed suicide. And ever since that, he's been down, down, down. And but he said, I'm not going to commit suicide because I know what that does to other people. But he has, apparently they've discovered a condition in his heart. And so he says, I'm not going to do anything about it because that way I'll only have 7 years or so. Apparently, he thinks, and, you know, none of us know. But you can't tell a guy with bipolar anything like that. So I gave up on that effort. But, you know, we all face things And the tragedy of suicide is that there's never a chance to get out of that pit. And so, at any rate, just to get into this text, I was reading something from Martin Lloyd-Jones, who was a great preacher. He actually trained as a doctor, medical doctor, before it just kept nagging him and nagging him that there's something else that God wants me to do with my life. And so he realized in the course of time that it was to serve as a pastor to a church. And after, I think it was 10 years at his first church, he then went on to serve Westminster Chapel in London for 30 years. 30 years. And the thing was, he was called to that church in 1939. Now, if you know anything about that year, that's the height of the Battle of Britain, when the Spitfires were going to meet the German bombers who were coming over to firebomb London and England, the rest of England. So, you know, the children were being sent away, just like in Ukraine now, were being sent away to the countryside so they'd be out of danger of this firebombing of London. And the Spitfires that rose, the pilots of those were the heroes of England. And Lloyd-Jones said, in this midst of this, faith is a refusal to panic. Faith is a refusal to panic. That was spoken to a people, remember, who were at the cusp of panicking. Were it not for Churchill speaking to them by radio, the king himself speaking to them by this new thing, the radio. And then Lloyd-Jones speaking to them these words of faith is a refusal to panic. That they stayed the course. Oz Guinness, in a message some years ago on what happened here to Paul and his companions on this terrifying voyage from Capernaum to Rome, said, "It's not death, it's life that defeats the Christians." We've always been equipped to deal with death, but it's the affluence of life and the ease with which we so often are able to live that really is our enemy. It's said commonly, there's no atheist in the foxhole. But it's afterward, after you climb out of the foxhole, that then you see what the words spoken in the foxhole really meant. The seas are, in fact, rarely calm for us in the course of Christian life, aren't they? In fact, I'd go so far as to say that it's when they're at their worst, when the waves are indeed crashing around us, that our faith is tried and tempered, like a knife is given its strongest, sharpest holding edge only when it's been in the forge of fire and quenched. I don't know if any of you have seen this show. I got kind of hooked on it, I got to say. I think it's called Forged in Fire. Anybody see that show? I mean, to me, it's fascinating to watch these guys take like a piece of a car and end up making a knife out of it over the course. And then they're given as the last assignment to win the prize some sword to make from some era or other. And the only way to get the edge to hold is to quench it after it's been in the fire. And that's the way it is for us as well, as Christians. The strongest edge we have is when we've been through a fire and come out the other side stronger. That's really what I was about trying to say to the kids with that weight. It's only by using the weights that you get stronger and stronger. It's only in athletic competition that you get better and better, isn't it? That's why Paul used those words of athletic competition so often. So here in chapter 27, let's look at it. And when it was decided that we being here Luke and the companions with it, as Luke has written this book, he's including himself on this journey with Paul, that we should sail for Italy. They delivered Paul and some other prisoners. As you'll see shortly, it was quite a few others in the ship, to a certain centurion on the Augustan cohort, of the Augustan cohort, named Julius. And embarking in a ship from Adramyttium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. The next day, we put in at Sidon. Sidon's just a sort of hop, skip, and a jump by way of a boat up the coastline from Capernaum. So it's not very far up the shore. Putting out to sea, we got the next day in at Sidon. And Julius, the centurion, treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. Putting out to sea again from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus. I had to look up what lee actually meant to be sure I had it right. Lee means to be having the wind facing you, not from the rear, but from your front. It can also mean being driven into the shore, having the wind going into land. In either case, what it means is that the ship you're on has to tack back and forth in order to make any headway. And it also means you've got to be really careful about running into the shoals of the land that are along the coastline. That in itself, I think, is not a great image for the Christian, for us as we walk the ways. We've got to be careful about the direction the wind is going. And if the wind is coming at us, we're going to have to tack back and forth to make any progress forward. That's why small groups are so important in the Christian life. That's why being together in some way or other, and especially being in the Word. I was trying to tell my grandson, you know, compare what you think with what God thinks. Look at the Word, because that's God's revelation. Of course, my grandson, he, I think, ought to be a lawyer when he gets older, because he'll argue anything, as will any teenager, I suppose. I remember my own, and I remember mine. So at any rate, it continues on. With the winds against us, when we had sailed across, I'm looking at verse 5, across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia. These are two Roman provinces in what's now Turkey. We came to Myra. Myra's a town in another of the Roman provinces, Lycia. There, the centurion came, found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy, and put us on board. Egypt was the breadbasket of the ancient world, just like our Midwest. Or, as we found out, I didn't know it before, but Ukraine is a similar breadbasket for the world. And so most of the grains that Rome ate over the course of its empire came from Egypt until Egypt was conquered by Islam in the 600s. So that's how important Egypt, and in particular Alexandria, which lay right on the delta of the Nile, was. And so the centurion found this ship sailing from Alexandria to Italy and put us, as Luke says, on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, as the wind did not allow us to go farther. We sailed under the lee again of Crete, off Salmone. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lasia. Now, I just if you happen to observe how often it says with difficulty. With difficulty. So not only think about that, is it true of Paul's journey? This we should expect with difficulty ourselves. We're going through a time of disaffiliation. Let me tell you, that's with difficulty to leave our United Methodist Church because of its drift from the Scriptures. But sometimes we've got to put our, as is said of Luther, our knife in the table and say, here I stand. I can go no further. In order to stay true to the Lord, it's going to be with difficulty. And that's how Paul ended up on this ship, and Luke with him, and his companions as well. And it was with difficulty that they journeyed on. And it's with difficulty that we ourselves can expect to journey on. Now, since much time, picking up in verse 9, had passed and the voyage was now dangerous, because even the fast, this was the fast of Yom Kippur, so it would have been in the early spring, early fall, when the storms begin to approach in the Mediterranean Sea. Since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast of Yom Kippur was already over, Paul advised them, saying, sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. This is what Paul thought at first. But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. You know, Paul was just a minor passenger in a way in this whole journey, wasn't he? The important thing was that cargo of grain. That was worth a fortune. If the owner of the ship could get it to Rome, he was going to be a wealthy man. Paul, to him and the crew, meant nothing. And because the harbor was not suitable, as it continues in verse 12, to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. Now, when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete, close to the shore. But soon, a tempestuous wind, called the nor'easter, struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. Running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. The ship's boat would have been like the lifeboat of the ship. They usually trailed it along by a rope behind them. And so in that situation, it would ride. But here they tried to drag it up onto the ship so they could turn it upside down and prevent it from swamping behind them. After hoisting the ship's boat up, they used supports to undergird the ship. What would happen is they would try and drag ropes underneath the entire ship so that they could then bind the ropes together and hope to hold the ship from breaking apart in such stormy weather. This continued, this practice, even into the 1800s for the ships under sail. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. Now, they must have been really off course by this time, because the Syrtis is down just off of Africa, the coast of Africa. They had started way up along Turkey in Crete, which is just below Greece. And here they are thinking that they're down near Africa. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. Remember, that was precious cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. I've got to wonder if Paul and the rest of them got seasick. I'll tell you what, I'd be so seasick, I'd be over that rail every other moment. Since they had been without food for a long time, probably because they were throwing it up, Paul stood up among them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of God, of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And this angel," he said, "do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar." This would have been Nero, remember. "And behold, God has granted you all, those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on some island." Take heart, men, for for I have faith in God. When the 14th night had come, as we were being driven along, this is 2 weeks, as we were being driven along the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms, so it would have been 120 feet, 6 feet to a fathom. A little farther on, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, they lowered the ship's boat, that lifeboat that they dragged normally behind. They lowered that ship boat into the sea under pretense of laying out anchors from the bow. Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved." Remember what the angel had said to them? All on this ship will be saved. But you've all got to stick together. Boy, is there a word for the church there? We've all got to stick together. Paul had said this to the centurion, so then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. As day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that you've continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for it will give you strength. For not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you." And when he had said these things, he took bread, and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves. These are the words of consecration for Holy Communion. To take the bread, bless it, break it, and give it. And all were encouraged. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. Now when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea. At the same time, loosening the ropes that tied the rudders, then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow stuck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. Can't you even... This reminds me of Treasure Island when I read it, or of Shipwrecked. How vivid the description of this is. The stern being broken by the surf. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any should escape, swim away and escape. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for land. The rest on planks or on pieces of the ship. And so it was that all were brought safely to land. And so it was that all were brought safely to land. The seas are not always calm. And Peter, in his first letter, writing to a beleaguered, persecuted church, wrote to them by way of encouragement. It is by God's great mercy that we have been born again, because God raised Jesus Christ from the dead. Now we live in great expectation, and we have a priceless inheritance beyond the reach of change or decay or shipwreck or folly. And through your faith, God is protecting you by His power until you receive this salvation, which is ready to be revealed on the last day. So be truly glad. There's a wonderful joy ahead. I'm reading from the new, what's that version of the Bible you use so often? Not the NIV. It's the paraphrase of the Bible. There's a wonderful joy ahead of you, even though you must endure many trials for a little while. These trials, now listen to this, as Paul faced them, as we face them, these trials will show that your faith is genuine. It is being tested as fire tests and purifies gold, though your faith is far more precious than mere gold. So when your faith remains strong through trials, it will bring you much praise and glory and honor on the day when Jesus Christ is revealed to the whole world. Or as another translation puts it, as the harvest of your faith, you reap the salvation of your souls. Perhaps you know the story behind Horatio Spafford's great hymn, "It Is Well With My Soul." Spafford was a prominent attorney in Chicago who specialized, of all things, in national and international law, teaching it even in what's now known as McCormick. He had extensive real estate holdings. He was a Sunday school teacher in his Presbyterian church and a benefactor of many things. And Spafford was influenced by none other than Dwight L. Moody, Moody Bible Institute being up there in Chicago to this day. Over the course, though, now listen to this, of only 10 years, Spafford experienced a string of disasters, almost comparable to the biblical Job. Remember whose wife said, "Curse God and die"? But far from that, this is what Spafford did. The first of the disasters was the death of his four-year-old son. And then, almost right after, he lost his fortune in the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. This ruined him financially. But Spafford became even more impoverished in the Great National Crash, economic crash of 1873, which was right in the presidency of Ulysses S. Grant. And in November, in spite of this, He decided that it would be a wise thing to go with Dwight L. Moody on an evangelistic crusade to Europe and take his family along with him. And so they journeyed across the ocean, and the Ville de Havre was the ship's name. At the last moment, something happened with his business, and he stayed behind. While crossing the Atlantic, a great storm arose, and two ships collided with each other, one the De Havre and the other the Loch Erne, and all four of Spafford's daughters died, drowned in the shipwreck. His wife, Anna, survived and sent the now famous message, "Saved alone." Shortly afterwards, Spafford got on another ship and went to meet his wife. You can imagine the grief they both shared. And as he crossed the place in which he was told the ship went down, he penned these words: "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to know." Our hymnal says "say," but he wrote, "It's taught me to know. It is well. It is well with my soul." Two stanzas that are not included in our hymnal, I think, are interesting. "For me, be it Christ hence to live. If Jordan above me shall roll, no pang shall be mine, for in death as in life, thou wilt whisper thy peace to my soul. But Lord, 'tis for thee, for thy coming we wait. The sky, not the grave, is our goal. O trump of the angel, O voice of the Lord, blessed hope, blessed rest, for my soul." What was it? That was said as we began. As the bombs fell, faith is a refusal to panic.